The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
The job of CID is to investigate this morning's murder. The job of Special Branch is to prevent this evening's murder, said Toby, a former Royal Ulster Constabulary officer who had agreed to meet me off the record, meaning that I would have to disguise his identity. A veteran of RUC Special Branch in the 80s and 90s, Toby was eager to make the case that he and his colleagues were all about saving lives during the events that have become euphemistically known as the Troubles. Well, that's how a new book, Agents of Influence, begins. And from there, we go on to meet even more covert figures who in turn reveal secret after secret about the Troubles. The author is Senior Lecturer in Defence and International Affairs at Sandhurst, Aaron Edwards. Good morning and welcome to the programme.
Good morning, Pat.
There are so many things in this book. It would take us a day to parse everything that you have revealed. But I suppose the most startling thing that you reveal is that the British had read the minutes of the General Army Convention of the Provisional IRA before they were even circulated to the members. And this is not fanciful speculation on your part. This is fact.
Well, that's correct, Pat. What I managed to do in the research for this book was not only to pick up on what former members of the security forces were telling me, but I actually read it in declassified documents that are known variously as intelligence summaries of events that took place a long time ago in the 1970s and 1980s.
How was that information conveyed? I mean, there therefore had to be a mole at those meetings.
Absolutely. So the intelligence attack against the Provisional IRA that I detail in the book was undertaken from a number of perspectives. So in terms of, one would imagine, electronic surveillance, but particularly from those human intelligence sources who had infiltrated the IRA. And so in the book, I talk about how they did that, how they essentially betrayed members of their own community and indeed members of their own family.
The IRA, of course, were suspicious when things happened that they did not predict happening and which only could have been revealed by intelligence. And they dealt with those within their own organisation who they suspected of being moles for the British fairly viciously, I suppose.
That's right. It's estimated that up to 70 people who were accused of being informers inside the IRA or close to the IRA were of course, brutally executed by a special Gestapo-like department within the IRA that is euphemistically referred to as the Nutting Squad. And, of course, this is very controversial even today. But what I managed to do was actually track down former agents who had got very close to those who were intimately involved in that internal disciplinary process, as the IRA would have seen it. And I detail the sort of dispatches from the front line that they brought back to their handlers.
You also indicate that there were those who were killed by the Nutting Squad who were actually wrongly accused.
That's correct. And this is, of course, contested because of the clause of neither confirm nor deny. And so it's very difficult to work out the veracity of some of the claims. All I can really do is report what I see and try and corroborate with other sources. And of course, I've in this particular book, for the first time, we actually see the intelligence that's been brought back from various agents inside the IRA. And not only that, as you indicated in your opening remarks about the about my book, we also find out intimate thoughts that senior figures in the IRA and Sinn Féin were having at that time before they were making them public. So I think that that is certainly a revelation from my book that that hasn't been made in quite the same level of detail that I bring with this piece of work. And so that would be, for me, very telling.
Now, what is so confusing about all of this is that there were so many different outfits who were pursuing intelligence. Obviously, at ground level, you're looking at the RUC and their intelligence gathering, but you've got the British Army intelligence gathering, and then you've got the more obscure figures pulling strings from London. How many competing intelligence gathering agencies were there?
Well, what I do at the outset of the book is to explain that there were three main intelligence agencies all gathering secret information to feed into the decision-making process for politicians and for senior civil servants. Those agencies range from the RUC, as was the British Army, and of course the Domestic Intelligence Service, MI5. It is quite a confusing and congested environment to navigate. And in lots of books about secret intelligence and covert action and troubles, and of course there have been quite a few, would explain some of this, but not in a very enlightening way. And so what I tried to do is really to show that not only were these agencies competing in some way, but when they finally got round to cooperating and working in partnership with one another, because they had rival worldviews, they viewed the world and they viewed the problem such as it was in Northern Ireland differently. When they worked together, then they managed to push the IRA and Sinn Féin into a position. They essentially boxed them into a position where the only alternative for the Provisional Republican Movement was to sue for peace.
Now, you report, quoting David McKittrick as early as 1980, that the competition between these agencies was immensely damaging to the overall intelligence effort. I mean, did each of those outfits regard themselves as, you know, having primacy over the whole thing? Because when you talked to Toby at the beginning, and you know, he was under the impression that they were just doing their own thing. They were a reactive bunch, and their mission out there was to try and save lives. But there was no kind of strategy behind what they were doing. It was all on the hoof.
That's correct. And I think from my point of view, I'm particularly interested in the strategy and how it interacts with, you know, the political agenda of the day, which was very much to defeat the IRA. And so I was asking questions of my interviewees, and indeed when I interrogated the documents, just to what extent it was actually serving government policy. So I think in 1979, I begin the book by talking about the events of Warren Point, the IRA assassination of Lord Mountbatten, and really detail the lack of cooperation, not just within those different agencies, but between the British and Irish governments. And then, of course, from 1979 onwards, it was a process, a very slow process of working together. Of course, because this book is about British security forces, about servicing the UK's national interest. So that, I think, from my point of view, I look at various episodes where that cooperation was in evidence. And as David McKittrick rightly pointed out all those years ago, where it was lacking.
The other, I suppose, aspect of this that we forget, there were many personnel involved on the military side, for example, who had experience of decolonization, of battles in the colonies, and they took a very colonial view of what was going on in Ireland, whereas others might have taken a more domestic view that Northern Ireland is an integral part of the United Kingdom and we police it accordingly.
Yes, and I think that that colonial mentality, I think, certainly existed in the 1970s, within a range of agencies. I think it was born out of a way of doing things in the colonies, and I've looked at this in detail in other places, in Cyprus and Aden and other books. So there was a templated approach about how intelligence-led operations should work and what they were there to do. But I think that because the situation had changed dramatically and Britain's empire had essentially crumbled, certainly by the late 1960s, early 1970s, it wasn't really appropriate for those techniques, tactics, procedures, call them what you will, to be applied in a very domestic setting. And so it caused a lot of problems, as we know, from various high-profile incidents in Northern Ireland from the 1970s. But what I look at in the book is this process from 1979 to 1997. So it's very much focused on, what the British security forces did in order to fight back against the IRA and to overcome some of those really imperfections in their approach.
In terms of dirty deeds, I mean, there are lives that were saved, they say, but presumably there were lives that were sacrificed as well for the ultimate aim.
I mean, this is a highly controversial aspect of the book, and what I did, any good journalist would do the same. I asked these hard questions of those who were senior spy masters within the RUC, particularly about just what was it, how did they approach this? And what they told me was that they, there was a lack of a legal framework and so on. So I think from a, from a philosophical point of view, I think they weren't prepared to disclose anything else. But we know from certain cases, ongoing cases, of course, it would be remiss of me not to mention the ongoing investigation into the alleged agent steak knife and the allegations that are made there about lives that were sacrificed. So I think because it's an ongoing investigation, I'm not a legal expert, but what I tried to do was look at some of those in the context of exactly what it was that was going on in terms of handling of agents. And so I could ask these questions. In fact, Republicans are still asking these questions. One of the features of the book is where I actually tried to get a 360-degree perspective on these ethical questions, where I asked Republicans what they thought about the betrayal and about the loss of some of their friends. And one interviewee in particular said that he believed that people were left up lonely country lanes and sacrificed to keep other agents in place. So, there's no doubt that certainly Republicans would admit that readily and would make those allegations. I didn't find so many of those former spy masters prepared to speak to me candidly about that.
So Paddy Flood, for example, a bomb maker in Derry, not a British agent, even though he was labelled as one. What about John Joe McGee, the head of the IRA's Nutting Squad? Was he the real steak knife? Is that the proposal?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a veil of suspicion hanging over John Joe McGee. Close readers of my book will see that it has been alleged by Republicans who worked closely, or allegedly worked closely with him or knew him from within the Republican movement, told me that there was suspicions there. Brendan Hughes, Brendan the Dark Hughes, who's a well-known prominent IRA man, he discovered a major informer within Northern Command, within the Internal Security Department of the IRA. And he was certainly on the case from 1986 of John Joe McGee and others. But just at the point when he closed in his investigation, his own investigation, he was promoted and moved upwards and away from that. So, I mean, these are, of course, allegations, but John Joe McGee has a very interesting background. He was a former British soldier and then rose to quite high prominence within the Provisional IRA.
Now, the notion that strategically the British, when they got their act together, were pushing the IRA and therefore Sinn Féin towards a democratically elected solution to the whole thing, and pushing Martin McGuinness into standing for election and all of that. There is one hero of the piece, I suppose, that's Brendan Duddy, who was an intermediary who despised violence, didn't think one dead body was a price worth paying for a united Ireland and all of that. But Brendan facilitated contacts between the IRA and the British. And there's almost an amusing little anecdote how his daughter described how she knew which side was actually meeting in their home.
Yes, so Brendan Duddy is a real hero, I think, of the peace process. And, of course, this didn't come out until much later. I had the opportunity to meet him in Galway when he opened his archive there. Brendan Duddy, for me, is a very complex character. Yes, of course, he becomes a well-known pacifist, but he's actually advising Sinn Féin in a strategic sense and people like Martin McGuinness, who were prominent in the IRA. And I think that he had such a sophisticated understanding of the conflict, but also of republicanism. And, I think he was instrumental, really, in, as you've said, in facilitating the contact between the British government and the IRA at various points in the 1970s and 80s and 90s. But in the 1990s, in 1990, 1991, of course, he arranges for that meeting between Michael Oakley and Martin McGuinness to be facilitated. And of course, the rest is history. So I think a very brave man, but complex, and certainly one who I think tried to steer Sinn Féin, or particularly the IRA, away from violence, but not in a way that one would associate with pacifism. You know, he suggested strategically that they had to look to politics because ultimately it was the only way to resolve the situation and for them to get what they wanted.
And he might have lost his own life. He heard them, the IRA, discussing whether or not they should do away with him because they were suspicious of him. But whenever there was a helicopter hovering over their home or nearby, she knew that the Brits were talking to to Brendan. Look, it's a fascinating book. As I say, we can't do justice to it in just a few minutes' time, but I would recommend it. It's compelling reading. And Aaron, thank you very much for joining us. It's called Agents of Influence. It's available now for around €20 from all good bookshops. And its author, Aaron Edwards, thank you very much for joining us on the programme today.